Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Soccer may be among the world's most international games, but when it comes to professional sports stateside, Major League Baseball holds the crown. With over a quarter of the current roster born outside of the U.S., English, Spanish, and Japanese spoken widely in bullpens, with players hailing from nearly 20 different countries, professional baseball is the UN of American pro sports. And as the sport becomes more international, one position is becoming crucial to running a successful team, the interpreter. Joining me to discuss the evolving role of interpreters in Major League Baseball is Eric Benson. His article for Grantland, Laughing With You, Darvish, profiles Kenji Nomura, the trilingual interpreter for the Texas Rangers. Eric Benson, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me, Virginia.
So Kenji Nomura has a fascinating background. How did he learn Japanese, English, and Spanish?
Well, Japanese is his first language. He was born near the city of Nagoya and grew up there until he was 11, then immigrated to the United States, where he had a hard time learning English. His father moved for business reasons to the Los Angeles area, and he struggled for 3 or 4 years in ESL classes, eventually had a girlfriend who was American, and that was kind of his great motivating factor to become fluent in English. And Spanish, he had taken Spanish in high school and then sort of fell in love with Spain, fell in love with a Basque woman in Spain, spent years in Spain, so then mastered Spanish as well.
So, as you say in your article, he is uncannily suited to the job. Beyond being trilingual, what makes him a great interpreter for baseball players?
Well, I think one thing about Kenji is that he's really thoughtful about language and culture, and his academic background is very much in this area. He studied Hispanic civilization. He was applying actually to become a PhD student in social linguistics at UCLA when he applied for his first baseball interpreting job. And so when you're dealing with players who are coming to a new country, a new culture, you know, he not only understands it from his own experience, from having been an immigrant to this country as well and having spent time in a third country, Spain, but he understands it from kind of an intellectual background. You know, he's also someone who knows the game, which is very important because baseball has its own language and baseball has its own culture and rules. And Kenji played baseball. Kenji was a baseball fan in Japan. And Kenji is also someone who's pretty discreet, which is important for being a baseball interpreter. You know, Yu Darvish is a huge celebrity in Japan. You know, he's somewhat of a star here. He's one of the best pitchers in the major leagues. But in Japan, he's a rock star. And there are a lot of people who want to know about Yu Darvish's personal life. And Kenji Nomura knows a lot about Yu Darvish's personal life. But part of his job is to make sure that he doesn't disclose those kind of things.
I see. So whereas Yu Darvish comes across as a little cocky, a little bit of a rock and roller attitude, you know, if we've seen pictures of cigarettes dangling out of his mouth while gambling, what would Kenji Nomura's role be in conveying that charisma without all of the stuff that people might find less charming?
Right. Well, I think, you know, in Yu's case in particular, he's funny. He's sort of has kind of a sarcastic wit, which came through earlier in the spring, earlier this year, when he was asked about the contract for Masahiro Tanaka, the Yankees pitcher who was signed for over $150 million. Yu makes close to $60 million for his contract. So Tanaka's contract dwarfed his, and he was asked about it, and Darvish kind of joked that he thought Tanaka was getting paid too much. So in that case, that's a case where it's hard for a translator because he has to convey something in a different language that's essentially deadpan. And actually, in that case, it sounded like pretty much everyone there got it except for a couple people or one guy who then tweeted it out as a comment without humor. And people ran with it and said, oh, you know, Yu Darvish is making $60 million, yet he thinks he's underpaid. You know, what an ungrateful guy. But yeah, I think conveying charisma is really, I think that's really the art of the interpreter's job, and it's really tough. It's not in some ways all that different from conveying passion in written language in a translation. I think the big difference is that there's so much of language that's not spoken. There's so much of someone who's a charismatic speaker conveys so much in the tone of voice and the way they speak. I mean, we can watch videos of famous charismatic people whose languages we don't understand and still get a lot of their appeal. So that is something that he doesn't have to worry about. But things like subtleties of humor are really where the job gets to be an art.
Eric Benson is with us. He's a magazine writer and wrote an article for Grantland that profiled a trilingual Major League Baseball interpreter named Kenji Nomura. How about the interpreter inside of the locker room in the bullpen, you know, where all of these jokes are probably flying around, all of these kind of insider statements? How does translating affect team camaraderie?
You know, it's really developed since the kind of the modern era of interpreters. And as more Japanese players have come in, I think teams have really seen the value in having an interpreter there to make the players' time easier, but not having an interpreter there to shield them from the rest of their teammates. So actually, one part of Kenji's job is essentially not getting in the way of you talking with his teammates, you know, facilitating it in the right times, but also allowing for that direct communication of you with other people on the team or you with his coaches and trainers and managers. So, you know, one thing that Kenji told me that was interesting on that is when he came to the Rangers, he told the coaches that whenever they spoke to you, he wanted them to make eye contact with you, mm-hmm. not with him.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very important that they were always speaking directly to you. And he would translate the words, but that the communication they were having wasn't with him, it was with the player. So I think there's a lot of that goes on in the clubhouse. He'll, you know, if you doesn't understand something, and he actually understands quite a bit of English. He doesn't really speak much English, but he understands some.
Well, and I'm sure it helps that Kenji speaks Spanish as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I heard Kenji speak Spanish much more in the clubhouse than I did Japanese, because he'd only be speaking to you, and you, when I was there, wasn't around all that much. But yeah, he seems to have a great rapport with the Hispanic players.
It was only a couple of years ago that fans never even saw the interpreter. Now you see him on the pitcher's mound between plays. Why has their role been elevated in recent years, do you think?
Well, I think there's been a number of factors. One, there are more Japanese players. I don't know. I think actually the peak of foreign-born players in the majors is now a few years ago. It's not significantly less now. It hasn't grown significantly every year since, you know, whenever that was, 2008. So there, you know, there's a greater visibility. I think there's a greater cognizance on the part of teams that it's really an important role. So it was actually in 2009. When interpreters were officially allowed in the dugout, although interpreters did come into the dugout before, they just weren't allowed to. They sort of hid from TV cameras and would talk if they were needed to for a conversation between a coach and a player. And yeah, and then in 2013, I think just bowing to the fact that there were more and more of these players, and there really isn't much of a good reason not to have them come out.
Has that transparency and inclusiveness in some ways of the interpreter changed how foreign-born players are perceived by fans?
You know, that's an interesting question. The moment when I got an idea for this story was in 2009 when I saw it was the Yankees had just won the World Series, and Hideki Matsui, the outfielder, Japanese outfielder, had just won the World Series MVP. And he was standing, he was doing his on-the-field interview afterwards with Fox. And Hideki doesn't speak English, really. So he had his interpreter there, a guy named Roger Kalon. And I thought Roger's answers conveyed so much personality and charisma that I thought, wow, is this how Hideki actually sounds in Japanese? Is this the personality that kind of we've been missing, or is this just Roger? And that question of where the personality of the interpreter took over, and how much of it was conveying the personality of the player, and you know, and how you can do something convey kind of simple answers, because the answers weren't particularly verbal. He was just kind of responding, yeah, you know, it's been a great time, but just the way Roger did it, I thought did convey a lot of personality. But I do think that it's really, it's hard, and you need a really good interpreter to do that. And really the better way, of course, is, you know, some of these players are learning English, and I think it's tough to, there's always going to be a bit of a barrier with English-speaking fans until a player is able to speak to them directly, because an interpreter is always interpreting.
And for an interpreter, sounds like a dream job. I mean, I'm guessing you get paid fairly well. If you love baseball, you're right there on the front line. But Kenji Nomura told you that his job can be emotionally draining. How so?
Well, he's the one conduit in a lot of fields of life for these players. You know, Yu, when he's in Dallas, has, I think, a personal assistant and has friends who are Japanese speakers. But, you know, on the road, it's a lonely life for someone who's, you know, who doesn't speak the language of the rest of his teammates. So, yeah, I think you're dependent upon a lot, and that's difficult. And you also have to, you know, you have to convey a lot of the good and the bad. And if a player gets injured, like happened with the first guy Kenji interpreted for, Takashi Saito, he got a close to season-ending elbow injury. And, you know, Kenji was the guy who accompanied him to the doctors, and Saito didn't really know it was wrong. He just felt something in his elbow, and Kenji was the one to break the bad news. So there's a lot of that being the middleman. But also, the baseball season's grueling. It's 162 games. There's long spring training before that. Pitchers and catchers report before that. So, you know, a guy like Kenji, he's, you know, 42-year-old guy with a family. He's away from Valentine's Day to Halloween, basically, if the Rangers do well. And yeah, it's a lot of time on the road, a lot of hotels, and you know, I think baseball's great, but after a while, it gets draining.
Well, Eric Benson, thank you for giving us a window into the world of the professional baseball interpreter. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
You can find a link to magazine writer Eric Benson's article for Grantland, which is called Laughing with You, Darvish, at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Even if you don't speak a foreign language, you're likely to recognize a few words while traveling abroad, like Wi-Fi, shopping, or hamburger. When Word of Mouth continues, how English became the leading source of loan words and why some countries are rejecting them. That's coming up after the break.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Native English speakers with little or no fluency in languages other than Pig Latin may have a tough time traveling abroad. Signs and menus are bewildering, asking for directions close to hopeless. You are bound to recognize a couple of words, like Wi-Fi, hamburger, or jazz. That's because English has one of the highest percentages of loaned words. Joining us to discuss the language's largesse is freelance writer and editor Britt Peterson. She's also word columnist for the Boston Globe, and that's where we found her column, English, Loanword Champion of the World. Britt, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
So you discovered the comfort of recognizing a familiar word amongst challenging ones when you went to Finland recently. Now, did you know any Finnish at all before you set out on your trip?
Not a single word. I guess I knew sauna, which I pronounced wrong, sauna. But other than that, I mean, Finnish is incomprehensible. It's not an Indo-European language. It's not even one of those languages that you can kind of, if you know a couple words, you can kind of sound out other ones. I'd been to Sweden before, and Swedish, if you know English and maybe you know a little bit of German, Swedish is, it kind of sounds like a little bit of slurred English. Finnish is completely different. It's like Klingon, but with more umlauts. It's literally like an alien language.
In this collection of consonants, there were some words that sounded or looked English enough that you could recognize them. What were some of them?
Right. So every now and then you'd be looking at a menu or something, and there'd be all these words that just a million K's, a million U's, a million P's. And then all of a sudden you'd see muffinsy, and you'd be like, okay, yes, thank God, muffins. I can order that. I'd be walking by a sign and I'd see hot yuga. That was one. And you'd say, oh, okay. I know what that is. That's a hot yoga class. I saw CrossFit somewhere. So a lot of people in Finland speak English. Basically, everyone speaks English pretty much fluently. And although there is actually a body in Finland that regulates the use of Finnish and often translates English loanwords, into Finnish and creates Finnish spellings for them, there are a tremendous number of borrowings from English into Finnish.
Now, the Finnish government is not the only government that's becoming a little bit more protective about its language. But first, help us understand how English, or when English, became this leading exporter of loan words.
So this is a fairly new thing, relatively, in the course of human history. For a long time, English was really a sponge of words from other languages. In the early days, in the medieval days, English was borrowing from Norse, from the Vikings. You know, it had the Norman conquest, so French, it had Latin. There's a tremendous number of Arabic words in English from the Crusades. You know, there's so many words that we don't even think about. Sugar, candy, lemon, lime, mattress, magazine are all Arabic words. So there were many, many centuries during which English was actually taking in many, many more words than it was borrowing. But then Britain became an empire, and it started exporting words all around the world. You can actually, in some ways, track sort of the political arc of an empire, or in some ways a language, by looking at the history of its loanwords. And English really went from being sort of a low-prestige language in the Middle Ages to being a very high-prestige language after the Renaissance.
Some of these frequently loaned words seem relatively recent. I'm seeing internet, Wi-Fi, hamburger, okay. When did that happen?
Right. So today, there's a lot of technology words. There's a lot of food words that there might just not be words for in other languages. I mean, you know, Vietnamese isn't necessarily going to have a word for internet. So when America started exporting a lot of technology and a lot of pop culture, there were a lot of countries that just simply didn't have words for these concepts, and so they exported the English word to make up for a gap in their language.
Well, there may be some credibility, I guess you could call it, in being on top in terms of loaned words. Not everybody is keen to accept those loans. Why is that?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I think it's partly because of the history of loan words coming during a time of conquest. You know, again, if you look at Vietnamese has a ton of borrowed words. And that's because for centuries, Vietnam was under occupation. It has a lot of loanwords from China. It has a lot of loanwords from France. It has a lot of loanwords from English. So there's a perception, and I think it's a real perception, that loanwords come in through subjugation. But I think it also, with English specifically, it comes in through anti-Americanism. I mean, I do think there's sort of a taint in that when you read things from France or from China, that there's a sense that their language is this very sort of pristine cultural object. And these American words are really sullying it. They're this sort of dirty Wi-Fi, email, you know, hamburger, things that like are just a little bit gross. You know, this language is a cultural product in China or France or in Iceland. And to bring in a word from outside is, you know, an unfortunate taint on the language.
I've actually heard that there is a ministry in France that helps to protect against words like le weekend. Is that true or is that an
urban legend? So the Académie Française regularly publishes articles sort of blasting Anglo-Saxonisms. They ran an article last year saying that they wanted to reconquer the French language. But at the same time, what's actually quite interesting is that French people use English words all the time. I mean, you know, le weekend, le shopping, le smoking is the French word for a tuxedo from smoking jacket. So there's an interesting gap in all of these countries, most of these countries really, between the sort of a very small cultural elite that really blasts English loan words and then the actual use on the ground, which is often very open and very sort of friendly to these often very useful, very convenient English loan words.
You mentioned a similar government body in Finland. So what do linguists think of these efforts? You know, governments kind of trying to stamp out on loan words.
You know, I spoke to a linguist, David Crystal, who's tracked this project in Wales, and the Gaelic languages are very small and embattled, and they're sort of trying to revitalize themselves after many years of not being spoken at all. And he sees language purism as actually kind of counterproductive sometimes because it can alienate younger speakers of a language. So if you're someone who really wants to talk about pop culture, you want to talk about food, you want to talk about things that are modern, and you have a government body saying, don't use a word to talk about music, don't use a word to talk about fashion, don't use a word to talk about technology, you're going to rebel against that body. You're going to want to keep on using your slang. It's similar in China, where the you know, the Chinese government is constantly saying, you know, don't use Wi-Fi, don't use VIP. But there's a, there's an element of rebellion among young people when they actually go on using these words. And it creates sort of a dichotomous situation between the actual speakers and a more repressive government.
Well, Britt, thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
Great. Thanks so much for having me on.
Britt Peterson, freelance writer and editor who writes about books and culture and ideas, and she's also the word columnist for the Boston Globe. Her article, English Loanword Champion of the World, appeared in the Boston Globe. You can read it for yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. The revelation that Facebook deliberately changed the news feeds of its users to test its influence on moods caused widespread outrage, but not everyone found it disturbing. When Word of Mouth continues, a researcher makes the case that the Facebook study was good for science. That's coming up after the news.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Late last month, Facebook made waves, not for changing its privacy policies or redesigning its news feed, but for news that it had tapped Facebook users as unwitting participants in a massive social science experiment. Back in 2012, Facebook manipulated the feeds of nearly 700,000 users, eliminating either positive or negative posts. And the results from the study indicate that the content of the social network can influence a user's mood. The news quickly went viral, not in a positive way, and has prompted investigations from privacy regulators in the UK and in Canada. Alongside the slew of condemnations is a contrarian view, one that defends Facebook's study and other examples of lesser-known corporate research. Clifford Lampe is Associate Professor of Information at the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor. His op-ed for the Chronicle of Higher Education is called Facebook is Good for Science. And Clifford, we welcome you to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me.
So in your op-ed, you admit straight away that you are a Facebook partisan. Now, what does that mean?
That means that I think that, well, I've done a lot of work with Facebook. So I have active research projects with people in the Facebook data science team, which is their research lab. Two of my PhD students are currently doing internships at Facebook. I've had postdocs and previous students go to work for them. So I feel like the research that they do is in line with the things I've been doing in academia.
And the data science team is the team that conducted the research in 2012?
It is, yes, them and they and some researchers from Cornell University.
So critics argue that by agreeing to the terms of service, participants are not really giving consent to being part of a psychological experiment. Now, why do you think Facebook deserves praise for doing the study?
I think they deserve praise partially because they published the study. So the argument that I'm trying to make is that this type of thing happens all the time as people try to improve their services that they offer people. Facebook and any other company like them is constantly tweaking their algorithm. So there's not one canonical version of the news feed that they manipulated to make different. Every news feed is adapted to the person by what Facebook thinks the person finds interesting. So in this case, what they did is they conducted a relatively normal study for how they would do things, and then they published it in a really highly respected journal, which to some extent is a great thing because that makes the power of the newsfeed algorithm available to people and educate us about how much we should care about how much these algorithms matter in our normal lives.
So they would do it anyway.
I don't particularly like that argument, and I know how ridiculous it sounds to people that they would do it anyway, but they would. Companies would do this anyway. And the danger that we have by, I think, especially in academia, taking a righteous indignation position on this is that it would chase this research into the dark, whereas having it in published peer-reviewed science serves multiple benefits.
Maybe I should backtrack and ask you, what were the results of this study? Did a more positive or negative news feed actually affect the mood, so to speak, of Facebook users?
That's been a source of pretty great debate, too. Even the most radical interpretation of the article would be that hardly at all, right? So that, yes, they found a statistical significance that if, for instance, you saw more messages that use negative or positive emotion words, you would might post more negative or positive emotion words in the future. But one out of 1,000 of the words that were posted were different. So it's a really, really small practical effect that they found. And the only reason that it was statistically significant is because they ran it over 700,000 people, as you mentioned earlier. The other thing that has been debated about that is really we're not measuring mood. We're measuring the types of words that we use when we post things on Facebook. So this could, for instance, some researchers have pointed out this could be more imitation than it is something that actually affected our mood.
Why, Clifford, can social scientists not do this kind of work without assistance from the corporations that they're looking at? So it's not considered to be an inside job.
Scientists do this work all the time. I think that's part of the reason why the psychologists involved with this didn't find it to be a particularly ethically concerning study, is because priming studies like this are used all the time in science. And in fact, in those priming studies, often informed consent is waived by institutional review boards or IRBs because it would basically give away the research and make it invalid. So I think in this case, there are two reasons why the Facebook stuff makes it so much more interesting than what we typically do in labs. One is the what we call ecological validity, which means that it's real, right? People are really posting these things in Facebook, and that's hard to replicate in a lab environment. People, when they're aware of being observed, they say things as if they're observed, which changes the nature of the science. The other thing that really makes this difference is the diversity of people that you get on Facebook as opposed to what researchers usually have access to. We've done 1 million studies on college freshmen.
Right, right.
And college freshmen do not represent the typical population. The Facebook sample that we have here is much more diverse, much broader, and looks much more like the American population than any group of psychology undergraduates will.
How about the value of the study itself? I mean, why should the public care about whether Facebook feeds influence our emotions?
Especially around 2012, when these data were collected, there were a lot of stories going around about how Facebook makes you sad, right? So we've seen a lot of stories like this over the past several years. And the dominant idea was, if I see you posting happy things, like you share all these stories.
Right, I thought it was more comparative. You know, it was sort of like when comparing oneself to another person, they would feel sad, not their news feeds.
Well, that was their hypothesis going in for these researchers as well, right? So if I saw more positive emotion from you, I myself would feel more negative. And that's not what they found. They found that if you shared more positive emotion, I post more positive things too. So, you know, that is exactly what we want out of social science, which is to have a narrative that we believe, which is that, you know, I have this negative comparison with you and find that it's not true by conducting decent science here.
You remember that Facebook study that people were all exercised about? Well, Clifford Lampe wrote an op-ed for the Chronicle of Higher Education saying that Facebook is good for science. He's making his contrary case with us today on Word of Mouth. Not all of your colleagues might agree with you. Andy Kramer, who is a scientist who worked on the study, has said, quite plainly, in hindsight, the research benefits of the paper may not have justified all of this anxiety. What's your response to that?
I think he's probably right on a couple of levels. One is it's important to remember they did not find much of a practical effect. So, you know, given the scale of what they did and the fact that there were things they could have done, I think, to alleviate people's concerns that they didn't do, you know, it is something to question whether the result is important enough for the concern that people have about this kind of research. And I think that's one of the really interesting things about this particular reaction is, you know, we're entering a new world where social scientists can kind of enter these types of situations, and it creates a whole new context for informed consent and human subjects reviews that we haven't had over the past 60 years that such protocols have developed.
I'd like to get to that point about alleviating people's sense that they were played because, you know, so many of us use Facebook. We get this new privacy policy. We just agree with it. Nobody ever actually reads it. But now they feel a little bit duped. Is that what the anxiety is all about, that they were somehow used?
I think there's a lot of things going into the anxiety that people feel, one of which I think this is wrapped up into general anxiety people have about Facebook, about the power of one company that one company has over all of the communication that you have with your friends and your networks. A second source, I think, is media narratives. This study was out for about a month before a couple of blogs picked it up. And by framing it, for instance, even in your introduction, you called it a manipulation of the news feed.
Mm-hmm.
I think even that framing kind of paints a particular way of shaping people's views of what the study was about. And then I think the third thing is that people really are legitimately concerned about, you know, the opacity of this newsfeed algorithm. And I think, surprisingly to people like me, so many people were surprised that the newsfeed isn't just this straight-up listening of what your friends have said.
If Facebook made the choice to feed particular kinds of news to a user group, what would you call it other than manipulation?
I would call it feeding their algorithm, basically. So it's, they do this all the time. Part of the reason why I don't like the term manipulation in this case is because it speaks to manipulating the users. And I think what Facebook is trying to do is to manipulate the content or to share the content in such a way that it's useful for people. You know, it is, of course, a manipulation of a type, but how the general public understands the word manipulation versus how I think Facebook intends to make the newsfeed work, is there's a slight framing difference there that's important.
What do you think Facebook could do differently to prevent this sort of controversy moving forward in the future?
Well, I think that my fear is what they'll do is just stop publishing research. You know, that would be the easiest thing for them to do. What I hope they do is really work on some mechanisms to protect users in different ways. And I know they've had some conversations about these as well, one of which is a more invested internal review process. They've also talked about having an external board of trusted academics that they've worked with in the past or external lawyers come in and do ethical reviews of work that's taken place or has taken place recently. They've talked about hiring external IRBs, similar to what universities employ, to look over work. There's lots of things they could do. I just hope that there's enough energy and enthusiasm left for them in doing this kind of research that they'll move that forward.
A contrary view of the Facebook newsfeed study from Clifford Lampe, Associate Professor of Information at the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor. Clifford Lampe, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
His op-ed for the Chronicle of Higher Education is titled, Facebook is Good for Science. And we'd like to know what you think. Are you still creeped out by the Facebook study? Would you be a willing participant of corporate research if they asked your consent beforehand? You can share your opinions on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. Stick around for a conversation with Sue Miller. The author of The Senator's Wife and The Good Mother discusses her latest novel. It's called The Arsonist. It's set in a small New Hampshire town where a series of fires divides the locals and the summer people. That's when Word of Mouth continues after the break.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. A series of arson fires thrust the bucolic town of Pomeroy, New Hampshire, into the national headlines. All the homes being burned belong to summer people, flatlanders, as the locals call them, igniting long simmering tensions between those who feel they own the town and those who merely use it a few months a year. Frankie Rowley is adrift from her job as an international aid worker when she returns to her family's summer home in the fictional town. There she stays with her aging parents and meets Bud, a former Washington newspaper man who's running the local paper. Together, they tangle with questions of class, belonging, and the meaning of home. The Arsonist is the latest novel from Sue Miller, author of several best-selling books, including When I Was Gone and The Senator's Wife. And Sue Miller is with us from WBUR in Boston. Sue, thank you so much for joining us.
I'm very happy to be here.
So Frankie was an aid worker based in East Africa for 15 years. So she makes her way home to Pomeroy, New Hampshire. This is the place her family's been summering since she could remember. What is she looking for?
Well, rest, for one thing. But I think she's hoping to find a way to make some decisions about her life. She's come back not clear whether she's going to return to Africa or whether she's going to stay in the States, but she's leaning towards staying in the States somehow, but isn't quite sure what she can do other than what she's been doing for so many years of her life. So this place, Pomeroy, has always sort of represented a kind of more home to her than any other place in the States. Her family was sort of, they traveled around a lot. Her father was an academic and had trouble getting tenure, so they were always moving. So this place is very special to her. She sees it as a place to rest, to rest up, to make some decisions, to be not to have demands put on her in some sense or another, a place where she can sort of recover in some sense.
The first night she's there, however, she can't rest, or does for a while. She has jet lag, wakes up in the middle of the night, goes out for a walk, and gets frightened off the road quickly when a car speeds by that could well be the arsonist's getaway car. This puts her right into the mystery and this tenuous relationship between the locals and the summer people that gets raised by these arsons. Talk to us a little bit about that relationship and how these the roles, the townies or the locals and the summer people kind of function for each other or have.
Well, I think in the past they function by, you know, ignoring whatever the issues and the tensions are between them, though they're present, and people sort of overhear things said. And at one point in town, Sylvia, Frankie's mother, sees a kid wearing a T-shirt that says, "Flatlanders, go home." So there's that kind of sense that underneath all of the kind of courtesy that their lives together requires, there is this feeling of resentment. And as soon as the fires begin, the resentment begins to cut both ways. I mean, the summer people are upset that the town isn't somehow protecting them better. And they don't want their summer idyll, as it were, interrupted. They're going to have to start locking their doors. They're going to have to start shutting all their windows at night. So it cuts both ways. That sort of longstanding occasional resentment of the year-round folks for these people who sort of descend on them annually, but whose income they need. I mean, they need the income that they get from them. It's sort of symbiotic in that sense. And then the sort of momentary resentment of the summer people towards the townspeople who've somehow let this thing happen, this arsonist.
Where does Frankie's family fit into this hierarchy, or where does Frankie think her family does?
Well, they're complicated because they were sort of original founders of the town. And for a long time, her ancestors lived there full time. And then several generations back, they began to just use it in the summer. So I think she feels pretty clearly that she is a summer person. Her mother, Sylvia, probably feels a little bit differently because her grandmother really lived there a lot of the time. And then Sylvia actually spent a full year there and came to have relationships of a different sort with people during that time.
Frankie meets Bud. Now, this is a man who was chosen to settle in Pomeroy. Unlike Frankie, you know, one foot in, one foot out in a way. He used to be a political reporter, I think Washington Bureau for the Denver Post or some other newspaper. Right. What was Bud seeking there in Pomeroy, New Hampshire?
Well, I think he felt tired of what political reporting consisted of. This all takes place in the Clinton era and the year when Clinton was president. And I think he's just tired of sort of the cliches of political life, as we all know about them, actually, and has a sense of also of not being at home. And there's sort of no home for him in Washington. It's so that he wants to go to he's grown up in a small town, actually, in Colorado. And he decides he wants to go and live in a place and be of a place where he will know everybody, where he will have an active role in the community. There's an article he reads about small town papers and how they're doing, and he picks out one that he's interested in and goes and visits this town, Pomeroy, which is a very beautiful town in the White Mountains, and decides this is it and buys the paper.
And, of course, he's run into, you know, the story of a lifetime, these arson fires. Yeah. So there's this kind of guilt about the opportunism of the work.
Right. He's actually very excited at the notion, after there have been several fires, it's sort of clear that these were not sort of accidental fires in some way. And he's excited by the notion that this is arson. This is really something exciting to write about. And then he is also feels like a jerk for feeling that way, of course.
What happens when the friction between modest folks who live in a town year-round and the chatty, self-assured summer people who come there for their leisure gets ratcheted up? This is one of the storylines of a new novel called The Arsonist by Sue Miller. I'm speaking with Sue Miller about it. It's interesting, Sue, setting these big world questions in such a small place, you know, this idyllic place, the threat of terrorism, for example, that seems so far away from the bombings and the embassies in Kenya and Tanzania that happened that very summer, where the book is set, all before 9/11, when this threat of terrorism felt so far away. Why did you choose to place it there in that summer?
Well, partly because of what was going on in the States at that time, which sort of comes up only a few times, but the discussion was largely about Monica Lewinsky and Bill Clinton.
We all remember.
And we do. And I actually once did a reading on the night that Monica Lewinsky was being interviewed by Barbara Walters.
Did anyone show up?
No. I mean, there were perhaps three of us. But Frankie is dismayed by the sort of lack of, you know, coverage of anything international or African even. So there was that to sort of look at and hold up and another sort of contrast between the life she's been leading and the life she would come into if she stayed in the States. So that was part of it, certainly.
There were a lot of different tensions percolating that very summer, as you were just talking about. But you're really taking on class in some way in America, and even hinting at a distance between classes is considered to be, provocation in many corners. It's kind of a daring thing to take on. Did you feel that way when you were doing it?
I didn't feel it was particularly daring, but I did feel as though to me it seems something that's really not, people are not comfortable with. I think people maybe will get more comfortable with it because it's such a glaring economic divide at this point in our national life that I think it's bound to be discussed more and more. But I think, when Obama speaks of it, he's accused of, inciting class warfare. Mm-hmm. We should just let this thing sit. We shouldn't be talking about it. It seemed to me this was sort of a very interesting context for it because it is a situation in which people have to make nice with each other. They rely on each other. It goes both ways. And yet there are some bitter feelings, certainly. So it seemed to me the kind of perfect example of it. I mean, in a big city, we live... We live separated into sort of economic ghettos in some sense or another. But in a small town, everyone, the houses look different one from another, perhaps, but everyone really has to, shops at the same store, says hello each day. All that sort of intimacy that happens between classes, among classes in a small town seemed to me to sort of make it, to be emblematic in a way of what goes on nationally but doesn't get discussed.
So well put there. But I do have to ask you, once, Sue, you've made a book that's been made into a film, as two of yours have been, thinking Inventing the Abbots and the Good Mother. Can you help when you're writing the book from kind of imagining the casting in a film?
I absolutely don't. they seem so much themselves to me. In fact, I've never seen the movies because I saw a trailer for it. We used to call them previews. And just realized if I saw the film, I would be forever thinking of the book in terms of the, of the actors playing the parts. And I wanted to keep my own notion of the characters in my head.
Well, that's amazing. You didn't see the film adaptations.
No, I haven't. I actually did in the end see Inventing the Abbots because a friend was sort of running a series of books into film, and she asked me to do that. So I watched it so I could talk with people who were participating in the series about the way I saw it differently from the way it had been made.
Well, it's such a pleasure speaking with you, and another great novel from Sue Miller. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
The Arsonist is the latest from Sue Miller. She's author of several other best-selling books. You can find much more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for joining us today. If you did miss any part of the show, fear not. Word of Mouth has a daily podcast. That's right, you can listen to the show in its entirety anytime you'd like. To subscribe, visit our website, wordofmouthradio.org. There you'll find a link to our full shows in iTunes. And if you like the show, please share the podcast link with a friend, whether they're in Berlin, Germany, or Berlin, New Hampshire, Lebanon, or Lebanon. You get the idea. Your friends can listen to the podcast wherever they may reside. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please come on back for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcasts and listen to past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
Follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
And check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.